Good evening, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, states sue to block massive cuts to medical research, while a federal judge says the Trump administration is ignoring his court order to pause a broader funding freeze.
President Trump announces new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, escalating his administration's trade wars.
And the Los Angeles area wildfires reveal a devastating new reality. In a world threatened by climate change, homeowners are increasingly left without insurance.
This is somebody who's always known what I was going to do and where I was going to be and all that stuff all my life. It just seems like there's a blank in my future.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Today, a federal judge said that President Donald Trump violated his order that lifted a blanket freeze on federal spending and again directed the administration to release the funds.
That, as top prosecutors in nearly half the country just won a temporary legal victory, restoring medical research funding stripped late last week. White House correspondent Laura Barone Lopez joins us now for more. So, Laura, we're 3 weeks into the Trump administration. You're seeing a growing number of federal judges describe the president's actions as overreach. What more did federal judges say about Mr. Trump's attempts to freeze some of those federal funds?
So on that sweeping freeze of federal funding, District Judge John McConnell said in a ruling today that the Trump administration's continued freeze of those funds, quote, violate the plain text of an order that he previously issued saying that they needed to stop and that they needed to release all of those funds. And Judge McConnell called Trump's actions, quote, likely unconstitutional, and said that the freeze continues to, quote, cause irreparable harm to much of the country. Now, he didn't hold any government officials in contempt, criminal contempt, but hinted that he might in the future if they violate this order. And he specifically ordered the administration to stop freezing money for the infrastructure law, for the Inflation Reduction Act, those are Biden-era laws, as well as said that that the administration needed to release funding for the National Institutes of Health. So the big question here, Amna, is does the Trump administration comply with this judge's order? I asked the White House. They didn't answer that question. And there's some suggestions from people like Vice President Pence as well as Elon Musk that they think that the administration should defy the court orders.
You mentioned the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. On Friday night, we should remind folks, the Trump administration announced it was cutting billions of dollars in NIH funding. We just saw a temporary legal victory for the case to let those funds move ahead. What should we understand about that case and its impact?
So now a second judge has said just moments ago that the administration needs to release that funding for the National Institutes of Health that goes to medical centers, that goes to universities, and it funds research for things like cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. And they said that the administration needs to show within 24 hours that they have released that funds, and they have to show that on an ongoing basis. Because essentially, the states argued that this is life-saving research that is being held up because of this block.
Meanwhile, we see Mr. Trump and Elon Musk's work to slash the federal workforce continue, this time with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Tell us about that.
That's right. Russ Vogt, who is the head of the budget office for the Trump administration, but also the acting director of the CFPB, that consumer watchdog group, he ordered that all CFPB staff stop working, don't come into the office. This is something that Project 2025 wanted to do. They wanted to eliminate the entire agency. But like the USAID agency for international development, it takes an act of Congress if you're going to dismantle any of these agencies or even try to transfer their functions. And so, again, it's a question of whether or not Congress is going to step in here. It's a playbook similar to what they did with USAID. And we did see today that despite, again, a judge's order saying that USAID workers had to be allowed to return to work and to reinstate their functions and the work of the agency, ultimately, those workers were barred from entering their office today, Amna.
Our White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez, with the latest. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Also today, President Trump signed orders to impose 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports to the U.S. two key American allies, Canada and Mexico, would be significantly impacted, but so would American businesses and consumers. For more, I'm joined by Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at The Wall Street Journal. Greg, welcome back. It's good to see you. Let's start with this announcement then of 25% steel and aluminum tariffs. A few days ago, you wrote in your column that the early verdict on tariffs was bad economics, better politics. Does this latest announcement here fit in with that pattern?
Well, only time will tell, but we'll have to sort of see what happens with this. We know from Trump's first term that when he imposed similar tariffs on steel and aluminum, the result was to create some additional domestic production and jobs in the steel and aluminum industries, but to significantly raise costs and cause a lot of harm in the industries that consume steel and aluminum. And that harm was compounded when our trading partners retaliated against those tariffs. And so the net effect was an economic negative. Now, fast forward to today, when President Trump a week earlier said that he was going to impose 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, we saw a very negative reaction in the stock market. That too suggests that investors expect that the net effect on this economy of these tariffs will be negative.
We should point out, too, that there's an intention here to target China in some way. China is not one of the top steel or aluminum suppliers to the U.S., and there are already existing tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum, even from the previous administration. So how would this latest potential move here, how could that impact China?
So I think that certainly Trump's first administration and to some extent the Biden administration made a distinction between China and everybody else. There was a recognition that China was a strategic competitor to the United States and that it did not adhere to the rules of global trade as other countries understand it. And so there was a better case for imposing high tariffs on China, notwithstanding the harm that would cause to those who import things from China. In this case, the president is not really making that distinction. He's saying tariffs on everybody, whether or not you're an ally. And that's because the motive here is to try and protect the U.S. steel and aluminum industries. Now, to be sure, China, even though it's not the specific, it's not being singled out in these tariffs, it's sort of there in the background, because one of the concerns that folks have had about tariffs and about China in the past is that even when there are tariffs on Chinese steel, it comes in through third countries, or China sells steel cheaply to one country, that country's industry suffers, and it sells its steel to the United States. So there might be, in a roundabout way, an effort to get at China. But that is, I think, kind of secondary. What Trump is saying here is he is willing to impose very high tariffs indefinitely to protect industries that are important to him.
Is it clear to you, though, what the actual goal is here for the Trump administration, especially when it comes to Canada and Mexico, the other tariffs that he's postponed as well?
Well, Trump's advisors put forth many different justifications for tariffs. They'll tell you, for example, that there's a difference between tariffs that are intended for negotiation or punitive tariffs. That's the tariffs that were threatened against Mexico and Canada as a way to get them to act on American concerns about the inflow of illegal migrants and fentanyl. And then there's a different bucket, which they call structural tariffs or strategic tariffs. And these are kind of indefinite, and they're meant to inculcate long-term economic and political changes, such as strengthening the U.S. manufacturing base or raising revenue that can help pay for tax cuts. So the tariffs that were threatened against Mexico and Canada a week ago fall into that first bucket. They were not, at least if you listen to the president, intended to be there forever, just long enough until Mexico and Canada did act, and it appears that they are acting on American concerns. The tariffs that the president announced today on steel and aluminum, and the ones that he said are coming, the so-called reciprocal tariffs on everybody, those are probably more in this second bucket of structural open-ended tariffs. And we can expect those to be in place for a very long time, because the problems that they're addressing, the very large trade deficit, are not going away in just a few months.
That is Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at The Wall Street Journal, joining us tonight. Greg, thank you so much. Good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
The day's other headlines begin in the Middle East, where a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas may be at risk. Hamas says it will delay the further release of hostages, accusing Israel of breaking parts of the six-week ceasefire agreement. So far, five swaps have freed 21 Israeli hostages and over 700 Palestinian prisoners. Hamas left the door open for the next exchange, it says, if Israel abides by its obligations. Meantime, more comments from President Trump have the potential for inflaming tensions in the region. He told Fox News that under his proposed U.S. takeover of Gaza after the war, Palestinians who leave would not be allowed back.
Think of it as a real estate development for the future. It would be a beautiful piece of land.
Would the Palestinians no have big the right money to return? Spent.
No, they wouldn't, because they're going to have much better housing.
That contradicts comments from administration officials, including White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt, who said last week that Palestinians would be temporarily relocated. President Trump has also pardoned former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. The president already commuted his 14-year sentence for corruption during his first term. Blagojevich was once on Mr. Trump's show, Celebrity Apprentice, and Politico reports that he's under consideration to be ambassador to Serbia. Romanian President Klaus Iohannis says he will resign after months of pressure and as he was set to face an impeachment vote. Iohannis is term limited, but after Romania's top court controversially scrapped an election back in December, it also kept him in office until a new presidential election in May. In the face of protests and a growing number of lawmakers who've said his extended term was illegal, Iohannis said an impeachment process would have only caused more pain.
Pentru a scuti România.
To spare Romania from this crisis, this useless and negative evolution, I resign from the position of President of Romania, and I will leave the day after tomorrow, February 12th.
Romania's Senate president is supposed to fill the role of acting leader until the new election is held. Opening statements started today in the trial of the man accused of stabbing author Salman Rushdie on stage at a lecture back in 2022. 27-year-old Hadi Matar had pleaded not guilty to attempted murder and assault. Rushdie was stabbed more than a dozen times, leaving him blind in one eye and paralyzed in one hand. The Indian-born British-American novelist had been a target of death threats for years after publishing his 1988 novel, The Satanic Verses. He's expected to testify during the trial. In Hawaii, a $4 billion settlement for victims of the 2023 Maui wildfire can finally move forward after months of legal delays. The state's Supreme Court ruled today that insurance companies may not take their own legal action against those blamed for the fires, including Hawaiian Electric Company. Insurers insisted they had the right to do so in order to recoup money paid out to policyholders. The case now goes back to a Maui judge for next steps. The fire was the deadliest in the U.S. in more than a century. On Wall Street today, across the board gains to start the new week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rebounded from last Friday's worst loss in nearly 4 weeks, while the NASDAQ shot up by almost a full percentage point. The S&P 500 also posted a solid gain. And Eagles fans can keep riding the high from last night's Super Bowl victory all week long. The team's star quarterback, Jalen Hurts, enjoyed a day at Walt Disney World, and the Birds will parade through Philadelphia on Friday, Valentine's Day, to celebrate their landslide 40-22 win against the Kansas City Chiefs.
You Philadelphia Eagles are Super Bowl champions!
Last night, watch parties across the city ended with cheers, even some tears from elated fans who then poured into the streets in droves. It's the second time the Eagles have taken home the Lombardi Trophy, denying the Chiefs their chance at the first three-peat in NFL history. Still to come on the NewsHour, the former acting Secretary of Homeland Security discusses the Trump administration's immigration agenda, a look at how the courts may serve as a check on the Trump presidency, and the insurance crisis laid bare by the devastating California wildfires leaves victims in financial straits.
This is the PBS NewsHour from the David M. Rubenstein Studio at WETA in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been shut down by President Trump, at least for this week and possibly much longer, perhaps permanently. The agency, which was created by Congress after the 2008 financial crisis, has limited credit card fees, made mortgage loans easier to understand, and returned billions of dollars to consumers. But it's also long been a target by many who see it as overly aggressive. Rohit Chopra is the former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and joins us now. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
So this has been known as one of the nation's most powerful watchdog agencies. Why? What has typically fallen under its purview since its creation?
Well, we saw what happened in the years leading up to the financial crisis, mortgages that were setting people up to fail, and it crashed the economy. So what Congress did is created some real law enforcement with teeth to take down crimes against consumers. And over the years, we have recovered billions of dollars of funds that were really taken from people. They were cheated, and it's back in their pockets. I don't think it makes any sense to defund law enforcement that is policing Wall Street, big tech companies, and others who are taking advantage of people who are just trying to get by.
And the broad scope of work is one of the reasons, as you well know, why Republicans have been targeting it for so long. Russell Vogt, who is the newly installed acting head of the agency, over the weekend, he tweeted this: "The CFPB has been a woke and weaponized agency against disfavored industries and individuals for a long time. This must end." To which you would say what?
Well, I don't know what on earth that means. The actions that have been taken by the CFPB in the past few years are against debt collectors who are illegally collecting on medical debt, against companies like Capital One, which have been withholding billions of dollars in interest, credit reporting companies who have tarnished credit reports improperly due to errors. These are things that people of every political stripe want to protect themselves again. And often consumers do not have much power against some of the biggest corporations in America. And that's what the CFPB does to level the playing field.
Well, apart from those who view the agency as being too aggressive, there are people who wonder if the functions could be carried out in another way. Every state has a consumer protection office. Why can't states do this work? Why can't the DOJ do this work?
Well, we tried that, and it was an enormous failure. That's one of the reasons why there was a mortgage crisis. There was not a dedicated group of law enforcers focused on this. If people want to play some sort of game of musical chairs that feels like pretext for actually wanting to sweep crime under the rug by some of the most powerful people in America, and that's just totally wrong.
During the first Trump term, the agency at one point requested a budget of $0. This was back when Mick Mulvaney was the interim head of the agency, and this was done as a way to defang its enforcement actions. What was the impact then, and what's the comparison between what was done then and what Republicans, what the Trump administration is trying to do now?
Well, when I took over as director of the CFPB, there was not much oversight over big companies. In some ways, there was concerns that it was just focused on small-scale actors. But just take a look in the last few weeks of the last administration, we saw the CFPB sue Capital One, sue Experian, one of the biggest credit reporting conglomerates, get $120 million back from Cash App, one of the biggest payment apps, and the list goes on and on and on. And I really think defunding this type of oversight is just begging for another financial crisis, and it's a complete giveaway to many of these big tech companies who increasingly want to become a bank.
What are the implications of this current shutdown? What work is not getting done?
Well, that's what I want to know. And we have to figure out, are all of the investigations that were in advanced stages, is all of that going to simply be deleted? And that means all of those consumers who might have been cheated and all of the companies and their executives, who's really winning in that? And it's clearly not consumers.
Rohit Chopra, former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Board. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
President Trump has spent his first weeks in office reshaping much of the American immigration system through executive actions and working to see through a campaign promise of mass deportations. For more on all of this, I'm joined now by Chad Wolf. He's former acting Secretary of Homeland Security in the first Trump administration and the current executive director of the America First Policy Institute. That's a conservative think tank. Secretary Wolf, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said last week that about more than 8,000 people had been arrested in immigration enforcement actions since President Trump was inaugurated on January 20th. We've seen reports recently that the president has been unhappy with the pace of arrests and deportations. When you talk to people on the inside, what do they tell you about the challenges of meeting some of these expectations?
Yeah, well, the number I've got is a little over 11,000, but I think it's a good first step. I think we got to remember that we're only going on the fourth week of the administration. So scaling up the number of folks removed from the country is going to take a little time. I think they want immediate results, given where the president has been on this. But there, as you indicate, there are challenges to doing that, both you need manpower to target and arrest individuals, and then you need detention space to put them in as they're being flown out of the country. So all of that takes logistics. It takes scaling up to be able to do that. But look, it's four weeks into this effort, and they're at a very high rate.
And we've seen, of course, some of the pace slowing a little bit. I think the highest single day arrest total we saw was about 1,100, over 1,100 early in Mr. Trump's administration. And correct me if I'm wrong, but there was reporting that of that total, about half of all of those, so about 600 people or so, were arrested as criminal arrests. The rest were what you call nonviolent offenders on civil immigration charges. Is that your understanding of the trend? About half of everyone arrested so far has been on a criminal arrest?
I haven't seen the exact breakdown of criminal versus non-criminal arrest within that overall number, but that doesn't surprise me. Look, they're going to target the worst of the worst, those criminal aliens. But what they have also said is as they target these individuals and they have to go into these neighborhoods and these cities, that they're not going to ignore other individuals that they come into contact with, meaning other individuals that are here in the country illegally and don't have a legal right to be here. What they often refer to as collateral arrest. So what we saw during the Biden administration is they would not detain those individuals. They wouldn't deport them. The Trump administration has said, well, that's, you know, ignoring the law. We're not going to do that. We're going to let ICE do their job. And so I think you're starting to see more and more of those types of arrests as they continue to roll out and look for those violent and dangerous individuals as well.
And so if that's the case, can you clarify for us? Because as you know, there are a lot of ways people can have protected status here, temporary protected status, TPS, for hundreds of thousands of people. DACA is another form of that protection, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. You probably saw there was a report out of Florida about a middle school teacher who was a DACA recipient, a 24-year-old teacher there who was reportedly detained, arrested, and deported back to Honduras after appearing for what the union said was a regular immigration appointment. And that's caused a lot of concern for people. Can you just clarify, if someone has DACA, are they protected from deportation?
Yeah, look, there's a number of relief that the U.S. state's government provides to folks. So whether that's temporary protective status, obviously you mentioned DACA, they could be in the middle of their asylum proceedings, right? All of those measures and relief have an ongoing process that you have to adhere to. Unless those individuals, for any number of reasons, fall out of status, and so they could commit a crime, they could do any a number of other things that make them fall out of status and then therefore eligible for removal. But if you do have some type of relief or you're in a process of doing that, then you're obviously not eligible to be removed.
Can I ask if you can share anything to help clarify some of the deportation flights we've seen to Guantanamo Bay? My understanding is there's been a few military flights already. It's been reported between 60 and 70 people so far. We've heard President Trump say that this is where what he calls sort of the worst will be sent. What is the bar for deporting someone to Guantanamo? Do they have to be convicted of a violent crime, for example?
Well, again, they're using Guantanamo Bay as, again, a staging area. Anytime that you target an individual, arrest an individual, you have to put them in a bed in order to hold them in order to line up a deportation flight back to their home country or back to another third country. So they're using Guantanamo Bay as a staging ground. And again, the Coast Guard has done this in the past with Haitian migrants, with Cuban migrants that they pick up at sea. So that facility has some muscle memory on how to do that. And obviously, for the number of arrests that this administration wants to see as they continue to scale up, they're going to need more and more beds, whether that is through the military at places like Guantanamo Bay, or that's through state and local sheriffs, or that's through private contractors. They're going to need more capacity to hold individuals as they line up flights to remove them out of the country.
Well, we should clarify, I guess the U.S. hasn't really held people en masse there from Cuba and Haiti since the 1990s. That generally stopped in 1996. And since then, there's been fewer than 100 or so migrants held at the facility there. But again, the bar for deporting someone from United States soil to Guantanamo Bay, is it clear to you where that is?
Well, I've continued to hear the worst of the worst, but it really doesn't matter what they've done. If you're eligible for removal, then they can move you to places like Guantanamo Bay. They can move you to other places that they have here in the United States, in Texas and Arizona and other places. Again, it's just a holding facility so that then you can be put on an aircraft and flown back to either your home country or another country that's going to repatriate you.
While I have you, I want to get a big picture question in here, because the agency that you used to lead, the Department of Homeland Security, which has the third largest federal department by workforce, was targeted in that outline in Project 2025 that was looking for ways to reshape the incoming Trump administration as a department that could be eliminated wholesale. And when you look at now the actions taken by Elon Musk and his team, looking for efficiencies, places to cut the workforce, what's your view on that? Should the Department of Homeland Security be eliminated or dramatically scaled back?
I would not advocate for wholesale abolishment of DHS, but is there places where you can trim the fat? Absolutely. So whether DOGE wants to come in or other groups of individuals should come in, take a hard look at the department. Where are they meeting their statutory mandate? Where have they grown or had that mission creep over a period of time? And where can they scale back, save the American taxpayer some money, but continue to keep America safe, protect the homeland, and do what was originally envisioned by Congress?
It's former Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf, now the Executive Director of the America First Policy Institute. Secretary Wolf, thank you. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
The start of President Trump's second term brought dramatic proposals and unprecedented changes to the federal government. That includes pushing the legal boundaries of executive authority. Our new series on democracy is taking a step back to look at the big questions about changing laws, institutions, and norms. Stephen Vladeck is a law professor at Georgetown University who focuses on federal courts and constitutional law. It's great to have you here.
Great to be back with you, Jeff.
So as Donald Trump pushes the limits of executive power, he told reporters yesterday that no judge, quote, should be allowed to rule against the changes his administration is making. Add to that a tweet from Vice President J.D. Vance, who appeared to question the judicial branch's authority after a federal judge temporarily stopped Elon Musk and his aides from accessing government systems. Vance said judges aren't allowed to control the executive's legitimate power. So that seems to at least raise the idea that the current administration is ignoring or defying, you know, ready to ignore or defy a federal court order. How do you see it?
So I don't think we're there yet. I mean, I think it's really important to note that even as we've had 47 some odd lawsuits challenging policies from the new administration, there's really no sign yet that the administration is affirmatively choosing to not comply with these court orders. You know, we just saw earlier today a judge in Rhode Island who said, here are a couple places where you're not complying fast enough. It's not really the same thing. I mean, I think the rhetoric here is far out in front of what's actually happening on the ground, which is an administration, at least so far, is largely abiding by these court orders, even as we see this dangerous rhetoric about maybe why they might not have to.
So how much discretion does the executive branch have?
I mean, historically, none. I mean, we should be very clear about this. The norm historically has been that when individual district judges, even in far off parts of the country, are blocking federal programs, the right remedy is to appeal. and to ask first the intermediate federal courts and then the Supreme Court to rule on the ultimate legality of the program. It's what we saw during the Biden administration. Jeff, it's what we saw during the first Trump administration with the travel ban. The reality, the sort of the danger in Vice President Vance's tweet is the assumption that what the executive branch is doing is legitimate. That's not up to the executive branch. Historically, that's up to the courts acting consistent with the separation of powers. And it's up to the branches working together to make sure that no one branch gets too far out of line.
So what would happen if this president, any president for that matter, were to openly and willingly defy a court order?
I mean, we've been lucky historically that we haven't had to face that problem. You know, the quote about Andrew Jackson and John Marshall is actually apocryphal. Andrew Jackson never said John Marshall should try to enforce this decision. I think what would happen is a political crisis, because the question at that point would be, you know, are the courts going to use other tools at their disposal? The federal government depends upon the federal courts almost as much as a plaintiff as it does when it's being sued challenging federal policies. So are courts going to fight back? Is Congress, which I think thus far has been far too acquiescing in what the president's been doing, going to push back? It's a red line we've never crossed, and one that we haven't crossed, Jeff, for good reason.
Well, on this matter of the president's unilateral efforts to reshape the federal government, Jim Jordan, who, as you well know, chairs the House Judiciary Committee, he was on one of the Sunday shows, and he defended the work of Elon Musk by making this argument that Musk is a proxy of the executive branch. Take a listen.
The Constitution is clear. Article 2, Section 1, very first sentence says, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America." First sentence in the section about the executive.
But you have a power of the purse constitution.
We do, but the it's the president. It's not a bureaucrat at USAID. It's not some staff person or some employee at the Department of Education. It's the president of the United States. And the folks who work for DOJ are federal employees carrying out the will of the executive branch leader.
Does that argument hold up?
I mean, only so far as it goes, Jeff, which is to say not very far. I mean, yes, the, you know, DOJ is an office within the executive office of the president. The president's allowed to have subordinates who do his bidding, but those subordinates are even more bound to follow the relevant statutory constraints as the president is. And in this case, there are mandatory appropriations that the executive branch is not abiding by. There are statutes limiting, for example, the ability to cut funding for NIH, which the executive branch is not abiding by. So, you know, I think that's a fair amount of deflection on the part of Chairman Jordan's part. The reality here is that we have an executive branch that is claiming the authority to exercise just about unfettered control over federal spending, over the federal bureaucracy, and at least through the vice president, over the federal courts. And, you know, James Madison wrote in one of the Federalist Papers that the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judicial, may justly be pronounced the definition of tyranny. We're not there yet, but there's a reason why these statutes are important constraints. There's a reason why we depend upon the courts to enforce these statutes. You know, just because Elon Musk has all of this sway within the executive branch doesn't change any of the legal analysis about whether the executive branch can really trample on these congressional powers.
And to your point, the system was never set up to have the courts be the only check on the executive, and yet that's the situation in which we find ourselves because Democrats are out of power and Republicans are giving broad consent to Donald Trump. So what are the implications?
I mean, I think the implications go well beyond our current moment. You know, our constitutional system is premised on the idea, to quote James Madison one more time, that ambition must be made to counteract ambition, that each of the branches should be pushing up against each other, even when they're controlled by folks who largely agree with each other. We have an ambitious president. We have an ambitious judiciary. We have a Congress that is doing almost nothing to assert its institutional prerogative. And I think that's a big part, Jeff, not just of where we are today, but why in recent years so many of our national policy fights have turned into fights between the executive branch and the courts. It's not sustainable in the long term, and I think we're starting to see a lot of evidence as to why.
How do you answer the question that some Republicans ask, which is, well, you know, isn't this what Joe Biden did when he tried to waive student debt? The Supreme Court said you can't do that, and he tried to find a path forward regardless.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, again, we ought to be careful to be nuanced here. So President Biden, after he lost on the HEROES Act version of his student loan program, tried again through a different statute. What he did is he said, I want to try to accomplish the same policy result through a legal authority the courts have not yet blocked. Now, he lost that one, too. But, Jeff, nowhere along the way in either of those rounds of litigation did you have President Biden or Vice President Harris or anyone else in the administration say the courts have no power to review the legality of this program. They conceded that they did. They just tried two different ways to get there. That's not new. President Trump himself tried three shots at the travel ban during his first administration. The third one worked. What's different about what we're hearing this week is the notion that there's something inherently illegitimate about federal judges reviewing the legality of what the executive branch is doing. That has never been how we've understood the relationship between the courts and the executive in this country.
So what will you be watching for moving forward?
A lot. I mean, there's a lot to keep track of. I think, you know, to me, there are a couple of real big pressure points here. One, which of these cases gets to the Supreme Court first? Two, how's the executive branch going to react if it loses in the Supreme Court? I mean, even this Supreme Court, which obviously, you know, gave President Trump a huge win last July in the immunity case, I think is not going to be inclined to, you know, completely restructure the separation of powers the way that President Trump wants to. If he loses in this court, is he going to abide by those rulings? And then third, Jeff, what is it going to take to get at least some Republicans in Congress, even a handful in the House, a handful in the Senate, to actually think that Congress's institutional prerogatives are worth asserting? What's going to be the red line past which we see those folks really begin to push back? I think that's the big question looming over all of this litigation activity.
Stephen Vladeck, thanks as always for your insights.
Thank you.
We are now seeing some of the first polling about how the American public views President Trump's second term so far. For that and the other political headlines of the day, we turn to our Politics Monday duo. That's Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Hello, hello.
Hello.
So President Trump has started his term with net positive marks from Americans overall. That's according to a new CBS News YouGov poll. He's got a 53% approval rating, and many of his policies have majority support, like immigration, his handling of the situation in Gaza. Amy, when you look at these numbers, what do you see?
This one poll definitely starts Donald Trump in a place he didn't spend any time in his first term, which is above 50% approval rating. Now, if you look at the average of all the polls that have been taken since he has started his tenure as president, he's a little bit lower than that, but still in positive territory. I think there are a couple of things to note about it. The first is, historically, his overall approval rating is lower than where most presidents have been. But what's the most telling and the most unique is how high his disapproval ratings are. Usually, a first-term president comes in, even though, as we know, this isn't your typical first-term president, but with a certain amount of benefit of the doubt from the other side. And so if you look at somebody, say, like Ronald Reagan, his overall approval ratings when he first came in weren't that high. They were somewhere in the low 50s, but his disapproval ratings were like 8. This is 47%. So there is a dug-in opposition to Donald Trump. That's why the number that's going to be the most important, I think, going forward is looking at whether that opposition to him grows rather than looking just at his approval rating number.
Yeah. Another important number in this poll, Tam, is that 66% of respondents also think he's not spending enough time on the thing that he was elected to do, and that's lower prices. I remember talk about the price of eggs being $4 being too high, and it's gone well above that.
I think it's around twice that much now. So the price of eggs is a very real issue that is affecting real people when they go into the grocery store, every time they go into the grocery store. Now, the reality is that's bird flu. It is not something that the president of the United States has direct control over. And frankly, the president of the United States does not have a lot of levers to pull to bring down prices broadly in the economy. That said, some of the things that President Trump is doing, including raising tariffs, just announced 25% on aluminum and steel, and other tariffs that he's talking about. Generally speaking, mainstream economists will say that raising tariffs is essentially raising prices on the American people in the end. So he is doing some things that don't seem to move in the direction of lowering prices. his White House is definitely not talking about prices very much. It is not their emphasis. Their emphasis is on things that they do have more control over, like immigration, like picking public fights, like, you know, saying that he's going to ban paper straws.
Yeah, and let's be clear, also in those polls, what people are telling pollsters is that they think that Donald Trump is actually living up to what he said he was going to do. So the fact that he's taking action and people see that he's actually following through on things, I've been listening in on some focus groups of voters who voted for Biden last time around, voted for Trump this time, and that's really one of the main takeaways was they said, well, at least he's doing something. He said he was going to try all these things, and he's doing it.
And it raises the question, Tam, how do Democrats and Trump critics, how do they respond to this? I mean, Democrats spent years saying that Donald Trump was in many ways unfit for public office. He was a threat to democracy. He gets reelected.
Right.
Now there are all sorts of concerns about this, as they see it, an unconstitutional power grab, and he's got this high favorability.
Yeah, so there's a lot of licking of wounds that is still happening among Democrats. Right now, I think as we speak, there are Democratic lawmakers and others protesting outside of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, protesting Elon Musk. I think that what Democrats have realized is that Elon Musk is less popular than Donald Trump, so they are certainly putting emphasis on him. And they are also trying, though they haven't exactly gotten there yet, but they are trying to bring the focus back to prices whenever they can, and they are trying to figure out a way to defend the government without defending the government, because it turns out a lot of voters think the government is too big and think the government doesn't work for them. And so Democrats are kind of struggling, I would argue, to figure out a way to defend institutions while not also defending the status quo.
There is this dynamic, though, where Donald Trump and Elon Musk, this approach of using a hammer instead of a scalpel in this effort to remake the federal government, it has the effect of hurting red states. We heard from Senator Jerry Moran of Kansas, who warned about USAID since foreign aid is directly connected to U.S. agriculture. Katie Britt of Alabama raised concerns about cuts to biomedical research at the NIH, how that could affect that state, not just Alabama, but Texas, North Carolina. The list goes on. We also heard from Senator from Susan Collins. Thank you. I was blanking there for a second. So, I mean, talk to me about
that. That's right. There are definitely repercussions to this, and you all have been reporting it on, too, of health centers that have not gotten their funding, et cetera. So there are real-life consequences that are happening to people in red states and blue states. That said, you know, when I was growing up in politics, there was the theory that all politics is local and that what happens to your constituents is the most important thing that you can do. You have to deliver for your constituents. All politics now is more national. And I think, to me, the most important quote that I have seen yet from an elected official about why they are choosing to support or at least not stand up and say no to some of the things that Trump is doing that might hurt them is the chairman of the National Republican Campaign Committee was quoted saying that, look, Trump has a mandate, and our job is to make sure that mandate gets fulfilled. Essentially, this midterm election coming up is a referendum on whether we fulfilled Trump's mandate. And to be clear, Trump did better in a lot of these congressional districts than they did. So they're looking at somebody who defied political gravity time and time again. It's going up against their old model of what politics used to be, and Trump has been beating the old model for a long time now.
As we track the many differences in this new model of politics, I'm not sure if we have time to play the sound, but Donald Trump, we do. So here's Donald Trump responding to a question about whether J.D. Vance is his successor. Let's take a listen.
Do you view Vice President J.D. Vance as your successor, the Republican nominee in 2028?
No, but he's very capable. I mean, I don't think that it, you know, I think you have a lot of very capable people. So far, I think he's doing a fantastic job. It's too early. We're just starting.
Can you imagine any other president giving an answer like that and it not being disqualifying or just completely upend the career, the future career of a vice president?
No, but this is Donald Trump, and he just says what he's thinking. And sort of transparently, he is saying, well, it's early. You know, Donald Trump is still joking that he's not going to leave office in 4 years. So, and also, he is
We assume it's a joke. I mean,
That's fair. But also, he likes to pick winners. He likes to associate himself with winners, and he kind of waits to see who's really going to be a winner.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a very good point. Plus, talking about your successor this early on is ceding your own power, and he does not like to do that.
Amy Walter and Tamara Keith, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Before thousands of people in Los Angeles lost their homes in the recent deadly wildfires, many of them had lost their insurance. William Brangham recently spent time in the region to better understand the state's insurance crisis as costs rise dramatically and coverage shrinks. As William reports, there is no easy fix, especially in a world dealing with the long-term impacts of climate change.
So your place was right here?
Right here on the corner.
This is all that's left of Peggy Holter's home of 47 years. Her townhouse, tucked in the hills of the Pacific Palisades, is now unrecognizable.
It's really hard on my son because he was born in this house and went to school, lived his whole life. You know, he said, these were the stairs where I waited outside after school for you to come and pick me up.
You know, in a matter of hours last month, the Palisades fire consumed her whole neighborhood. It left just a few small reminders of the past, like this tea set she was given as a child. For now, this retired journalist is staying with her son.
I just don't know, and this is somebody who's always known what I was going to do and where I was going to be and all that stuff all my life. It just seems like there's a blank in my future.
Your life savings was in this property.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're not going to get any of that, nearly all of that back.
No.
Holter says that's because her insurance company, State Farm, dropped her policy last year. They cited the condition of her roof, something only her homeowners association could address. It was part of a massive insurance retreat from this area. In 2023, State Farm, which is California's largest insurer, said it wouldn't write any new policies in the state. Then, last year, it declined to renew about 30,000 existing policies here, including over 1,600 in the Pacific Palisades. The company said the rising cost of rebuilding and the risk of extreme weather was too great.
Other than that...
But even for those who did have insurance, like Holter's neighbors, Pam Nye and Chuck Foster, the fires have been devastating.
As a home, as a place, as a refuge, what was it like?
A place where you felt loved, a place where you felt comfortable. It was just a little piece of heaven.
Since their home and neighborhood burned, Nye and Foster have bounced from hotel to hotel. Before the fires, they were paying farmers insurance about $5,000 a year for coverage, which they say included fire protection. So after they lost everything, they went to meet with farmers in person, hoping to speed up their claim.
They asked us a lot of questions, and then at one point they said, you really have no coverage, you have flood insurance. I looked at her and I said, that can't be right.
Farmers didn't respond to NewsHour's request for comment, but Foster and Nye have been calling their insurer almost daily, looking for clarity while reflecting on all they've lost.
I couldn't believe in my wildest dreams that would ever happen to us. I always thought that despite the fact that we were living in the mountains and living in a forest, that we would be safe.
Imagine you're looking for a place to live. A neighborhood like this looks pretty appealing. Beautiful houses up in the hills, surrounded by woods. I mean, who wouldn't want to live here? But if you are an insurance company, this neighborhood looks very, very different. A place like this with houses surrounded by forests is a potential disaster in the making. And that's exactly what happened here. And this is why insurance companies have been leaving this area in droves.
California has been in the grip of an insurance crisis for about 7 years before these fires hit.
Amy Bach is executive director of United Policyholders. They're a California-based organization that helps people deal with insurance companies.
Consumers were getting dropped regularly from insurers that had been insuring them for decades. People were having really hard time replacing their coverage. Competition had slowed to a virtual standstill in a lot of zip codes. People were increasingly having to turn to either a brand name they'd never heard of or the state-supported insurer of last resort.
That insurer of last resort is called the California Fair Plan. And as the private market shrunk, the Fair Plan exploded, more than doubling the number of policies in the last few years.
Does the Fair Plan have enough money in reserve to cover the cost of these wildfires?
The Fair Plan will have enough money and will remain solvent.
Ricardo Lara is California's insurance commissioner. Last year, to move people off the Fair Plan and bring private insurers back, Lara's office pushed through a series of reforms, including allowing companies to consider future impacts of climate change when setting rates, and letting insurers pass along the cost of insuring themselves, what's known as reinsurance, to homeowners.
If we're going to ever get to affordable rates, we have to get to tackle the availability issue. Insurers have to come back to California and expand in order to bring down the cost. And that is what the reforms do.
Lara says his job is to strike a delicate balance.
You have to make sure you have a solvent and strong market and that you have the consumer protections to make sure that they can pay out those claims when people need it. My role right now for these fires is to make sure that they're paying out the claims that they owe to Southern Californians who are trying to rebuild, recover after these catastrophic fires. If they don't do that, I'm going to go after them.
In a statement to the NewsHour, State Farm said it's already paid out more than $1 billion in fire claims and is, quote, bringing the full scale and force of our catastrophe response teams to help customers recover. But last week, the company asked Lara to approve an emergency rate hike averaging 22%, saying, quote, we must appropriately match price to risk.
Okay.
Lara's office is now analyzing the proposal. And he says these wildfires prove that climate change is already upending everything about the state's insurance market.
Here we're talking about fire today, but there's sea level rise. There is extreme heat. There is catastrophic flooding from atmospheric rivers. Climate change has affected every aspect of our lives. And I would be lying to you if I told you that doesn't impact insurance.
Back in the Palisades, Chad Comey and his family, like a lot of Californians, had already been priced out of the private insurance market. This complex was where his family lived for three generations, and they've lost everything. The exterior was covered by the Fair Plan, but he says any claim likely won't be enough to rebuild.
I don't know if we'll be able to keep it in the family, just the financial hardships that come with being with one for us not having insurance on our unit.
So you guys had no insurance whatsoever for the inside?
For the inside, no insurance, no.
And why is that?
My parents couldn't afford it. They're living Social Security check to Social Security check, and it was never financially feasible for them to purchase insurance.
Peggy Holter's exterior was also covered by the Fair Plan, but like Chad Comey, she thinks the payout will be far less than her home's actual value. Meanwhile, State Farm has offered to renew some of the policies it dropped in the fire zone, but Holter believes she likely won't qualify.
What about the argument that the insurance companies make that it is just too dangerous to have people living in what could be and turned out to be a tinderbox, and that they can't take that risk?
When this was built, it had everybody's approval. They chose to insure it for 47 years. I mean, what's good? They made money off people for 47 years. That's the point of insurance, isn't it? That you chip in, and when somebody else needs it, they get it, and when you need it, you get it. But in this case, they're saying, we're sorry, too bad.
These wildfires could turn out to be the costliest in American history. So for this region to rebound, the state and its insurers will have to find a way to manage the growing risks of living in a warming world. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Los Angeles.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. For all of us here at the PBS NewsHour, thanks for spending part of your evening with us.